Good evening. You're listening to WNUR 89.3 FM, HD1, Evanston, Chicago. I'm Vidit Shridhar, and this is WNUR News at 6. Tonight, an Indian food alternative to Tech Express. Are movie adaptations rewriting canon? And, a deep dive into gossip. Those stories and more coming up. From Northwestern University, this is WNUR News at 6. Tired of Sarge and Norris? This $7 lunch option could be what you need to fight off winter blues. Tilly Freed has the story.
It's lunchtime in Tech, and the cafeteria is a buzz. Some students whip out wild cards to pay for poke, while others pull out Tupperware packed from home. But there's a third option for those in the know, and devotees swear it's the best around. Mana's Kitchen, started by Anoop and Sumita Mana in 2018, offers freshly packed and delivered tiffins every weekday. Tiffin is a South Asian term for packed lunch. For McCormick doctoral student Diptamon Kundu, Mana's meals are part of a busy daily routine.
But I don't like cooking. And maybe, I also don't get time to cook. And as I told you, I don't like and I'm not much interested.
Kundu has relied on Mana's $7 platters of Indian food for a quick and healthy lunch for the past 2.5 years. Communications grad student Archita Arun treats herself to Mana's every few weeks.
It feels authentic and also feels like it's made with a lot of love.
Mana's Kitchen serves many international students.
My parents live in Mumbai, in India, so I've been living away from home for a while, almost 10 years.
Arun describes Sumita's cooking as a taste of home.
I was like a very picky eater growing up, and my mom was working. So she would like find ways to incorporate healthy things into food that looked unhealthy and fried. So something like this, like a zucchini corn kofta, is exactly what she would make.
For Arun, the food quality, portions, and price make it well worth the 15-minute trek from her classes on the south side of campus.
It feels very much like a secret, because the humanities people don't know about it.
Although it's not a secret Arun wants to keep.
So I guess I have to spread the gospel.
To try Mana's Kitchen, you need an in. Orders can be placed through the over 400-member WhatsApp group. On Saturdays, Sumita sends out the rotating weekly menu. The menu offers 3 to 4 vegetarian and non-vegetarian options per day.
Either rice or chapati, which is like your carb source, your staple carb source. And then with that, there's like some sort of like multiple types of curry. Usually there's a main curry, which is in a small box.
That was Mana's Kitchen loyalist Anurup Mohanty, a PhD candidate in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences. Mana's Kitchen, unlike Uber Eats or campus food options, is run entirely by the two owners, who cook and deliver the food.
This just feels like I'm supporting an actual person.
Sumita and Anoop politely declined my interview request, but the couple is dedicated to serving their customer base.
I was so busy in my experiment, I actually forgot to pick up my tiffin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and when I went there, it was not. The tiffin was just gone.
When Kundu's tiffin went missing, Anoop Mana rose to the occasion.
He contacted many other students as well if someone else took my tiffin and well.
In the end, Kundu's tiffin was not recovered.
Like, the bad thing was, I gave him the payment, but he didn't accept it. He returned me back the money.
Sumita also encourages feedback on how she can improve the food quality. Mana's Kitchen and its WhatsApp group have fostered a community between the students, lab assistants, and doctoral candidates who rely on their service, bringing a little joy and simplicity to the maze of tech.
I like how I can literally see who is eating what every single day. It's kind of weird, but at the same time, it's kind of fun. It connects people.
And now, that community is reaching back to Sumita and Anoop. Kundu and Mohanty, who are roommates, want to show their thanks to the Manas.
Like, we planned that at least before we graduate, we would at least invite both like Sumita Manna and Anu, like to like come to our house to give them some party because they saved us a lot of time. Yeah, for sure. Like we have this plan in future.
Would you cook for them?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Why not? I mean, we can cook, but we just don't cook.
For Mohanty, Mana's Kitchen is the answer to the fundamental question. Eat to live or live to eat?
You would be eating food for nutrition rather than for joy, and like they make it possible to enjoy the food instead of just eating it for the sake of eating it.
In Evanston, Tilly Freed, WNUR News.
Adaptations of classic literature are famous, from Paradise Lost to 10 Things I Hate About You. But when does an adaptation of a famous work become fan fiction? And can iconic fan fictions like 50 Shades of Grey be counted as part of the pantheon? Mika Ellison has the story.
It's London, in 1988. At the Old Vic Theatre, director Jonathan Miller is staging a production of Shakespeare's The Tempest. The Old Vic is no stranger to Shakespeare. Something's a little different about this one. Instead of submitting to Prospero's words as he leaves his enchanted island, Ariel, his magical servant, retrieves his destroyed staff and puts it together again, raising it above his head. A play about colonial rule is now about the transfer of political power in a post-colonial society. Fast forward to 2011, when writer E.L. James's self-published erotic novel, 50 Shades of Grey, becomes a worldwide bestseller. It was also famously Twilight fanfiction. So what do 50 Shades of Grey and a production of a Shakespeare play have in common?
I'm Jen Comerford. I'm currently a visiting assistant professor in the English department at Northwestern. This quarter, I'm teaching a class called Fans and Fiction, Adaptation as Critique in Literature and Film.
Professor Comerford considered both of them when she was putting together her class syllabus.
My class is largely about, as the title suggests, how adaptation is a different mode of critique. And so part of this is thinking about like how we can kind of expand or put pressure on the kind of traditional ideas of what the literary canon is.
Using canonical texts like Austen and Shakespeare, Professor Comerford's class explores the limits and possibilities of adaptation. And, as its name suggests, it also asks if fan fiction, or fan-made stories about characters from books like Twilight and The Hunger Games, count as part of the legacy of adaptation. And although they're not exactly the same, Professor Comerford pointed out that there's certainly a lot of overlap between fanfiction and adaptation and why they come to exist.
You know, adaptation or fanfiction or things like that are indicators that these texts aren't, you know, there are things in these texts that aren't giving everything that people need or want.
To get the student perspective, I sat down with two Northwestern students who have read and written fanfiction. Here's Abigail Jacob on why and how she first found fanfiction.
I don't know if you know The Legend Trilogy by Marie Lu. I was really into that when I was in middle school. And spoiler for anyone who hasn't read it, it has a very bittersweet ending. And that like emotionally wrecked me at 2 a.m. in my bed. So it's like, okay, there needs to be a different ending. So I go online and I search up like, you know, book name, alternate ending. And I find this magical site called fanfiction.net. And that was the beginning of everything.
Sometimes fanfiction happens because readers want to explore new possibilities. But other times, it's because they want to critique or explore nuances that weren't present in the original work.
There's this adaptation of Pride and Prejudice that we're going to be reading part of called Longbourn, which is told from the perspective of the servants in the household. So, I mean, already, you know, there's a lot of criticism about, you know, the way Austen kind of attends to a very narrow range of like social classes, right? So like the servants don't really pop up that much. And so it's interesting from that standpoint already to be paying attention to, okay, what are the servants doing? And that changes, for instance, the way that I then look at Pride and Prejudice, because I'm a little bit more attuned to pay attention for the moments when the servants do pop up.
Like Professor Comerford, NU student Asha Mehta has a piece of fan-made fiction that felt significant for how it interacted with the source material. This one is about the recently rebooted television show She-Ra, specifically the romantic relationship between the characters Catra and Adora.
There's this story called Don't Go. It's about 5,000 words, and it's sort of this, like, episode 9.5 of season 5 of She-Ra. Basically, you know, Catra and Adora, they're like a lesbian relationship that wasn't able to be like fully realized in the show. It's not smut, it's just like a romantic fanfic about like them getting closer and sort of processing everything they've been through. And it wasn't, you know, probably allowed to actually be included in the show. So whether or not Andy Stevenson, the showrunner, is the one who wrote that, I think either way, it was a really beautiful piece of fanfic.
Abigail Jacob had a similar experience with a Sarah J. Maas book.
So I read Throne of Glass in middle school, and like it was like both like my thing, but also not my thing. I had like a lot of problems with it. I think a lot of people liked Throne of Glass, and it was hard to find people who like had my same opinions. Like, this could be improved, and this could be improved. So then I find like this fan fiction online, basically pointing out all like the moral dilemmas and like plot issues and stuff that I had issues with, and they were like rewriting it to like actually like talk about like the issues of slavery and like multiracial identity and stuff like that. And I was like, you know, like it was like the instance where fanfiction is doing it better than the actual book, in my opinion.
Fanfiction is often considered adaptation's weird younger sibling. It's unregulated, not traditionally published, and to be honest, varies a lot more in quality. But I asked Professor Comerford about why she thinks it's still worth it to give fanfiction its flowers. Here's her answer.
I think that one of the things I feel like that doesn't get given a lot of credit in literary studies is this like idea of like enjoyment or pleasure in reading. Like that's kind of besides the point. Everyone kind of assumes, sure, if you're here, you probably like to read. But like whether or not you enjoyed the text is not the kind of main question. And I think fan fiction, maybe this is part of why it gets slightly denigrated in some ways, is because it kind of leans into this question of like how can we enjoy what we're reading, or like make it speak to us in a different way. And that I think there's a lot of value in that we don't necessarily always give credit to.
So fan fiction and adaptation share a lineage, although they start from and are sometimes bound by source texts. They provide the opportunity for a piece of literature to become something more than what it was. They're a chance for readers to not only listen to a piece of writing, but to speak back to it. The source text is the start of the conversation, and not the end. Also, in case you were wondering, stage productions aren't the only adaptations of Shakespeare out there.
I just remembered that I did read Shakespeare fanfiction at one point.
For WNUR News, I'm Mika Ellison.
Versions of the game Telephone have been around for centuries, but it's more than just a silly childhood game. You didn't hear it from us, but Telephone, or gossip as we call it in real life, is a cornerstone of human social interaction. Tilly Freed and Georgia Kerrigan will let you in on the secret.
First, a statement gets mumbled down a line of players. Along the way, they may or may not mischievously mishear and miscommunicate the tidbit. Then, what's announced at the end sounds completely unrecognizable from what was first said. Think you haven't played telephone since elementary school? Chances are you never actually stopped. It goes by a different name, but gossip is essentially the same game. To hear about the woes, and even the pros, of gossip, I went where all age groups converge and where whispers are welcome, the Evanston Public Library. Summer is 32 years old. She said that she likes to listen to gossip, but she called gossip a generally negative thing.
It's always felt very high school-y, even as an adult.
When I talked to Summer, she admitted that her recent gossip had backfired.
I was actually just gossiping to my friend about my other friend this morning on FaceTime. And I think it got taken, like, I think they communicated, and I think it got taken the wrong way. All I was doing was expressing care, and I think she got offended. So now I'm like, this just happened this morning, so yeah. I'm like, maybe I shouldn't say anything to anybody. So. Yeah.
If games have rules, then gossip should too. But what exactly are the rules? And who gets to decide them?
I think it's fine if you're talking to someone who's not also their friend. If I talk to a stranger about it, fine. But if I'm talking to, like, one of our mutual friends, then it gets back to her. That's the problem. That's what the problem is. It's like a game of telephone, and things get misconstrued.
Summer is not alone in her struggle to determine when to play the gossip game. 10-year-old Aura navigates the same question.
Sometimes I don't, like, pass on the gossip because I don't want them to feel bad and I don't want them to get mad at me. But, like, if it's just a joke, then I tell it to other people. But, like, if it's, like, a crush, I won't tell the person that they're talking about.
But not everyone believes that you can gossip harmlessly. Kevin is a 71-year-old Chicagoan. There is no gray area in how he defines gossip. It's the sharing of unverified or confidential information. And it's something that you never want to be known for.
You'd almost feel like sinking into a hole, so to speak. You just, you like to be above the fray. And I think you develop, when people trust you and you don't violate their trust, that then it begets more trust. And then once you, versus the person that trusts you with something, and then you violate that trust, and it's kind of like they're never going back to you with anything. You know what I'm saying?
Kevin's rule for gossip? Cut it off.
If you're going down that path, you might just proactively say, I don't feel comfortable with where this is headed. You know, that's kind of how I would stop it. You know, rather than it being like a 10-minute gossip session, you kind of get it at the beginning, you know?
And if you let it spiral out of control, it can have big consequences, as Ara notes.
Because if you tell the wrong person, then they're going to tell everyone in the entire school.
But if gossiping can be so bad, why do we do it? Here's Ara's mom, Ashuma.
It is a way that people in our society bond.
And experts agree. Researchers from Stanford University and the University of Maryland published a study in 2024 about why gossip has endured over time within all sorts of social groups. For one, they found that gossip could be a survival tool that teaches us about others' reputations and who we can trust. But it can also teach us how to behave properly, so we aren't the subject of bad gossip. And when gossip seems like a game of telephone gone wrong, it's still a form of entertainment, stress relief, and social bonding. But how do we keep our game of telephone from turning harmful? Here's Ashuma again.
I think you just have to consider the person who's being discussed, just consider their feelings and, you know, is this something you'd be willing to say around them or have them know that you said it? And how would that feel?
According to Merriam-Webster, the word gossip originally comes from the Old English combination of god and sib, which refers to someone of close personal and spiritual connection. Kevin stays true to this etymology. He believes that if you're giving away someone's personal details, it should be only to your inner circle. Under those parameters, he was able to process issues in his marriage with his friends.
So after about a year, there's about one or two couples I trusted in the neighborhood. And I actually asked them I needed some one-on-one time and share what was going on. But I didn't feel, if someone said, well, were you sharing gossip with them? I was sharing information that was affecting my life, and I didn't have a sense of anybody. I mean, it's like you're talking to yourself about it, but I just looking for some sense of support and some sense of feedback, like, what would you do?
Because as much fun as a game of telephone can be, nobody wants to get wires crossed.
Would you, like, say you want to gossip less in the future when you get older?
Yeah. I'd want to listen to it less and also give it less,
For WNUR News, I'm Tilly Freed, with production help from Georgia Kerrigan.
And now, for a brief, gossip-free look at the forecast. January is not letting go kindly. Tonight's temperature is in the teens, with a chance of snow. A winter weather advisory is in place as well until 8 p.m. today. Saturday also brings a likelihood of snow and cold temps, with a high of 26 and a low of 13. The first day of February may see a slight temperature increase, though, with a high of 26 and a low of 21. There is also a chance of snow Sunday night. Taking a look into the headlines in Evanston, Chicagoland, and across the nation and globe. Many Evanstonians are taking to the streets following recent clashes between Department of Homeland Security agents and protesters in Minneapolis that have resulted in the death of two U.S. citizens. Prominent agencies in the department include Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, and Customs and Border Protection, CBP. Today, around 150 Evanston Township High School students voiced their displeasure in Fountain Square. Northwestern students and community members also gathered at the Weber Arch this morning for an ICE Out demonstration. Anti-ICE sentiments were also on display in Chicago. Multiple small businesses there have closed for the day, joining a nationwide general strike movement that calls for, quote, no school, no work, and no shopping, end quote. NationalShutdown.org, the movement's website, cites the move as a response to the deaths of Rene Good and Alex Preddy in Minneapolis, as well as Silvero Vegas Gonzalez in Franklin Park and Keith Porter Jr. in Los Angeles. All four were shot by federal agents. In lighter news, the United States posted its highest life expectancy on record at 79 years in 2024, the latest year with officially published data. Health officials cite a decrease in COVID-19, cancer, heart disease, and overdose deaths as reasons the country is striving towards more life. And lastly, the 2026 Winter Olympics will kick off next Friday in northern Italy. The United States is fielding their largest ever winter delegation, with 232 athletes expected to compete. That's all for WNUR News at 6 p.m. For more news updates and reports, follow us on X at WNUR News and Instagram at WNUR News 893. You can listen to these and other WNUR news stories on our website, WNURnews.org. That's WNURnews.org. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Our producer today is Krishna, and our reporters are Taylor Free, Mika Ellison, and Georgia Carey. I'm Vivian Patrick. Catch our next newscast Monday, February 2nd. Now, back to schedule.